You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, are we seeing echoes of the Rwandan genocide in South Sudan?
What is going on here is disgraceful. What we have seen in Bentu town, in Rubkana town, is utterly horrible and beyond description.
Hundreds dead as shocking footage emerges showing piles of bodies. James Schneider and Matthew Jamieson will give us their analysis. We'll also hear whether Rio is in any shape to host the World Cup as protests grip the city just blocks from Copacabana Beach. And we'll ask if military strikes in Yemen will go anywhere to root out Al-Qaeda. Plus, we're joined in the studio by the author of a new book who tells us how one building in London became a haven for Russian spies.
There's 32 flats in all. There's about seven spies living in them, more or less at the same time, running very, very important spies. And they didn't seem to know anything about one another.
Plus, we'll check in with our woman in Amsterdam and we'll review the week in theatre. A very busy edition of Midori House is ahead right here with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in today's programme. Before we get started with all of that, let's catch up with the latest news. Here's Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Investigators say they're hopeful the discovery of objects washed ashore in Western Australia will help unravel the mystery of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau is examining photographs of the objects found 10 kilometres east of the town of Augusta, to establish if they're linked to the Boeing 777, which went missing in March. ATSB officials say the images have also been passed to investigators in Malaysia. The operation continues to be disrupted by heavy rain, low cloud and rough seas. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott has promised to continue the search despite no sign of wreckage so far.
At the moment, we are conducting an underwater search with the best equipment that we have currently available, of an area of just under 400 square kilometres. If at the end of that period we find nothing, we are not going to abandon the search while there is reasonable hope of finding something.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia will respond if its interests in Ukraine are attacked. His comments are seen as drawing a parallel with the 2008 Georgian War. Speaking on Russian state TV channel RT, Mr. Lavrov also accused the United States of running the show in Ukraine. Vice President Joe Biden arrived in the capital, Kiev, on Tuesday to confirm US support for a unified Ukraine during a meeting with MPs. A senior Egyptian police officer has been killed by a bomb blast in the capital, Cairo. Security officials say Brigadier General Ahmed Zaki died when his vehicle blew up in a western suburb. A second officer has been shot dead in Alexandria during a raid on what officials say was a militant's hiding place. Rival Palestinian organizations Fatah and Hamas have announced a reconciliation deal after a meeting in the Gaza Strip. They've agreed to begin negotiations to form a unity government within the next few weeks. The deal comes as peace talks between the Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israel are breaking down. US President Barack Obama has arrived in Japan at the start of a tour of Asia. He'll hold a summit with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Thursday before visiting South Korea, Malaysia and the Philippines. Speaking before the start of his tour, Mr. Obama reassured Japan that the islands at the center of its territorial dispute with China are covered by a bilateral defense treaty. There are fears violence may break out between Sherpas who want to climb and those who don't following the recent avalanche on Everest in which 12 of their comrades died. The government announced on Tuesday that it will raise the minimum insurance cover for Everest guides by 50%. It also said it would set up a relief fund for the welfare of bereaved families and pay for the education of their children. New Zealand-born expedition leader Russell Bryce says tension is running high among the roughly 400 Sherpas at the base camp.
These guys are signing papers, but I'm not sure they know why they're signing the paper. Are they signing the paper to agree with the demands that we've sent to the ministry? Or are they signing the paper to stop climbing? I saw many people signing, and then they go back to their camp and they're actually not sure what they signed for.
Two astronauts have just finished a short spacewalk to carry out repairs at the International Space Station. American astronauts Rick Mastracchio and Steve Swanson spent just over an hour and a half replacing a computer known as a multiplexer demultiplexer, or MDM. The 10-year-old MDM is one of 45 on board the ISS. It broke down after a routine restart operation last month. Houston controls say the replacement MDM is working well. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. And Bill Bingham will be back at the bottom of the hour with some world news headlines for you. Listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London, 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day here in studio are both James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome to you both. Great to have you with us on the programme. We begin today with a horrific massacre in South Sudan that's claimed hundreds of lives. Fresh fighting between the army and rebel forces broke out once again today, many fearing a brutal civil war or even whether this could be the start of a genocide. Before we discuss that point in detail, let's hear this report from Monocle's Phil Hahn.
It's the worst massacre the world's newest democracy has ever seen. In the town of Bentiu, more than 400 people were slaughtered, hundreds more injured. The United Nations said the attack took place last week after rebels captured the oil town.
What is going on here is disgraceful. What we have seen in Bentiu town, in Rubkana town, is utterly horrible and beyond description.
It's understood that civilians were killed along ethnic lines and that some rebel commanders used radio broadcasts to separate them. Even at one hospital, newer men, women and children who refused to applaud the attacks were killed. It's a charge that one rebel commander denies.
I don't have that report. We don't kill those who are in the mosque. Maybe I think they, who are those people? We don't know. We did not enter the mosque.
Late last year, fighting erupted after allegations of a coup by former Vice President Riek Machar. In the following months, tens of thousands have been displaced and hundreds more killed, plunging the country on the precipice of civil war.
This is a political crisis and urgently needs to be dealt with through political dialogue. There is a risk of this violence spreading to other states, as we have already seen some signs of this.
Last week's events are a scary echo of the genocide in Rwanda, which claimed more than 1 million people. Incidentally, this month will mark the 20th anniversary of that genocide. Many praying it won't be repeated here in South Sudan. For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
That was Phil Hahn reporting there. James Schneider from Think Africa Press, if I can start with you. It's difficult to maybe avoid comparisons with those sorts of things, particularly with this symbolic, 20-year anniversary. Do you think we are dealing with, or are we on the brink of dealing with, a genocide?
It's a very different situation. We're definitely dealing with mass killings along ethnic lines by armed groups, which I think is bad enough. And from that point on, trying to kind of pass out exactly the definition becomes something that historians should do rather than people who are interested in reporting on, analysing and acting about the whatever the, what the current conflict is. I mean, the links to Rwanda are useful in a symbolic sense in terms of gathering greater interest and awareness about what's going on in South Sudan. One, in terms of international action two in terms of forcing and pushing for negotiations, but also really importantly, the humanitarian relief effort is really badly underfunded. I mean, humanitarian relief efforts tend to always be badly underfunded, but this one is particularly so. And when the humanitarian relief situation is particularly difficult in South Sudan at the moment, because one, the areas that the most of the violence or the worst violence is, the rebel-held areas are quite remote and difficult to get to. And that's about to get worse because the rains are about to come, which makes crossing the country more difficult. So whilst it isn't like Rwanda in a huge number of ways, and no sort of analyst who knows a lot about both of them would draw kind of strong comparisons, it is very important that people are aware, and it is useful in that sense.
And just before we talk a bit more about the aid and maybe the involvement of other actors from without, just to characterise, if you can, the sort of the specifics of this ethnic division. What sort of problems, how deep rooted and how sort of intractable are the divides?
So this goes back a reasonably long way. During the long civil war within Sudan, before South Sudan became independent, there was essentially at least two civil wars taking place. One between the north and the south, and a second one within the south. So Riek Machar, who is the former vice president, the sacked vice president, who is the leader of the current rebel group, spent most of the 1990s fighting on the other side from the current ruling government, the SPLA, in an inter-South Sudan civil war. And that was along ethnic lines. So this is between the Nuer and the Dinka. The Dinka are the largest ethnic group in the country, and the Nuer are the second largest ethnic group in the country. Now, this does have strong kind of social resonances, as in people are aware of ethnic difference. People do think along ethnic lines, and that is one of the roots of the violence. But there are also very large political causes or political motivations for this, because the way in which the SPLA, so the army that fought for independence for the south and then became the government under a party arm rather than the military arm, but it's still run by all of the people who were generals. How it was formed and reformed was, it just took in other rebel groups that it would previously fought against. And so it was very easy to gain rank and gain seniority within the nascent state and within the military and within the rebel group by saying you had a problem, going out to the bush with a few hundred men and some troops who would probably be along your ethnic lines, forming a small ethnic militia and then getting recuperated and brought back in, but with promotions, which is why the South Sudanese army has so many generals relative to the rest of the population. So it is deep rooted. It's not new. This doesn't mean that it's just the kind of free expression of hatreds which exist in the general population. There are lots of political and other economic causes that drive this, but this is the ethnic element is real, and people are being killed along ethnic lines, and not all of that is directed from the very top guys at above. It's a bit more decentralized than that, which is what makes it a bit more scary, actually, because it can go off a bit more like wildfire.
A complex situation which James is describing there, Matthew, and very alarming watching from the West without any question. To pick up on some of those points we discussed, particularly the difficulties in terms of delivering aid to those people who might need it, but also unpicking some of the sort of Western rhetoric, because once again we've had the US saying this is, an abomination. Well, that's all well and good saying it.
Yeah.
What can actually be done? What's your view?
I mean, absolutely. It's always so difficult with these situations, because we always hear from the politicians and the policymakers when something like this happens, never again, never again. I mean, with the Rwandan genocide, at the time, the current national security advisor, Susan Rice, was in the Clinton administration. And she said that if anything like Rwanda ever happened again, she would ensure that, you know, she went down in flames trying to stop it. We don't really see that happening from the White House at the moment. The same is true, of course, over Syria as well. You know, we had the Bosnia situation, hundreds of thousands killed, and we said never again. And now it's all happening all over again in Syria. So really, I don't actually think much is going to happen, quite frankly, to be blunt about it, because we have to take a look from a realist perspective here from the West. You've got Ukraine, you've got Syria, you've got huge tensions and problems in Asia. You've got massive economic challenges from China. I don't see the appetite in the United States for getting involved in further, you know, peacekeeping operations in Africa. The United Nations, quite frankly, doesn't have the political will, as we've seen over Syria. It's completely paralyzed. So really, I think, quite frankly, this will probably just run as it happened in Darfur. Nothing really from the outside was ever done to stop that. And I don't see very much coming externally, even though the United Nations Security Council in 2005 passed R2P, the responsibility to protect. And this, of course, enshrined the concept of humanitarian intervention into international law and gave it a firmer basis. But it's never really been acted upon. And I don't see how it will be applied in South Sudan now.
A bleak assessment, James. Do you sort of go along with that largely? Should we look to the UN? Could they supply more troops? AU forces? Where do people? Is there anywhere in terms of practical assistance that we can look now?
There are some things that can be done. The relief agencies can be better supported. There can be more robust mandates given to the UN forces, although they actually that their mandates aren't actually too much to blame for how things are going on now. So there are some small things that can be done, but they are mitigatory and they are alleviating. They aren't going to the fundamental roots. And in that sense, I do completely agree with Matthew that it isn't something that there are the current tools to fix. But I think the reason why this happens and it keeps on happening is that it's very easy to say, right, well, we've learned the lessons from this, we're not going to let it happen again, as if it just didn't happen because people didn't sit around the table enough and go, oh, come on, guys, let's do something. This is actually really bad. Have you read this report? It's awful. Let's do something. It's because the mechanisms and structures that would act as soon as things start happening are never put in place, because those things require very long-term political will and they tend to be quite expensive. So in cases like this, it's involved, you know, it's setting up transnational justice, which doesn't seem just that it only takes on African leaders. It's involved setting up regional security architectures that can operate. It's giving much greater regional capacity for creating humanitarian corridors and keeping parts of the country safe and isolating problems. But all of these things take money and they take really long-term political will, and you can't just do them by saying a few statements and pledging a few million pounds, a few million or a few hundred million dollars or pounds now, which is what tends to happen. Then that money doesn't all fully arrive. It kind of pushes the situation away so they don't have to deal with it anymore, and then the next one can happen. So really, whilst each particular situation that happens, this one in the Central African Republic and others, are all in their own right horrendous and deserve huge amounts of attention and help, they should drive us to building ways in which these won't happen again, which involve quite slow and painful building of justice and regional security architectures and mechanisms so that these things can't spiral in the way this has.
Let's move on now and discuss some events, protests indeed, which are taking place in Rio de Janeiro. Hundreds of angry residents from a favela just blocks from Copacabana Beach turned out to protest against an alleged beating which resulted in the death of a young man, alleged at the hands of the police, of course. Fires broke out near the famous tourist area of the city, and we are, of course, only months ahead of the start of the World Cup. Matthew, it is interesting, isn't it, how we tend to get these stories that focus on, you know, bad news for cities, host cities of events like this. Mm-hmm. People obviously quick to discuss, you know, their readiness or lack of it to actually stage this kind of event. What's your take? This is obviously bad news in sort of news terms. It's bad news in PR terms. Mm. Do you think it paints a portrait of a Brazil that is not ready for the World Cup?
No, I don't think that would be necessarily fair. It's very interesting, as you say, because these sporting events, like the World Cup, like the Olympics, have actually taken on quite a significant geopolitical context now. I mean, China, the Beijing Olympics in 2008 was really used by the Chinese government as a way to showcase the new 21st century China's debut as a major power on the world stage. Again, Putin recently with the Winter Olympics in Sochi wanted to use it as a propaganda tool. But
do you think that works, though? Is it sort of oversimplification from some of these leaders? They just think, well, put a big event on and it'll all be great and we'll get the great press all around the world. Are they too reliant on these events, do you think?
It is superficial. I mean, it's more, you know, symbolic, really. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's more of a sort of, you know, a vanity PR ego exercise in terms of, you know, the packaging around it and so on, not the actual sporting events. But for the masses around the world, the images and the messages that it sends out are very important because it gets that message home. China is here. We're now back, you know, as a major power. And with Brazil, don't forget, you know, Brazil's economy is now bigger than the United Kingdom's. It's a very significant rising world power in this new sort of, you know, multipolar world. And it is, I think, ready probably to host the World Cup.
James, do you think that we're sometimes too quick to, you know, look for negatives, highlight problems, and we see events in certain developing economies? We saw World Cup in South Africa, of course. And as Matthew points out, I mean, Brazil is a much bigger sort of fish in that pond, though still, you know, developing in its own way. Are we too quick to point out the sort of perceived failings in the West? Should we look more at, exactly as you were talking about before, these longer term benefits that these sorts of events and this kind of profile can bring?
I don't think that we're necessarily more critical about big global events taking place outside the West as in our own. I mean, remember the London Olympics, there was a huge wave of everything's going to be terrible, the traffic's going to be awful, the stadiums won't be ready, it'll be incredibly embarrassing, it'll rain the entire time and it'll just be a big flop and we'll be really miserable and very, very English about it. And it turned out that we somehow managed to hack that and we made the weather great and there was no traffic and the stadiums were good and the sport and we won medals and it was nice. And I sort of imagine that something along those lines will probably happen with Brazil. But there, and the idea that tourists won't come because of there's some ideas of violence, I think completely misunderestimates the kind of insanity of football supporters. They love it. They will go. But there is something underneath this which is interesting, because the protest movement against it has been quite large and it's been domestic and it's been recent. And that's sort of highlighting, again, how these are big coming out parties, but they're not really necessarily big coming out parties for the whole population. Mm. Again, you know, obviously you can see that in China, obviously with the enormous level of corruption and huge overspend in Sochi. And then in our own way here in Britain, with the huge emphasis that had to be put on legacy written through everything and, you know, that got what, you know, was easily satirized. So I think that's interesting, that the population is standing up and saying, we want some aspect of this. We would like some more control. So in that sense, there could be a positive spin. The people want to have more control of the fruits of Brazil's rising, and they'll get a really good World Cup probably, and probably quite a great Olympics, and they'll be fun.
There we go. That's a bit more upbeat. I like the sound of that. Those are the insights of James Schneider. Matthew Jameson is here, of course, as well. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll discuss whether anti-terror operations in Yemen can do anything to stop the growth of Al-Qaeda. And we'll hear whether political ads can ever go too far. I think we all know how that one might end. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, alongside me, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. We're wrapping up some of the big stories of the past 24 hours. We're turning next to a massive anti-terror operation that's taken place in Yemen. It's believed US Special Forces joined with their Yemeni counterparts in a series of attacks targeting Al-Qaeda training camps, bases and hideouts. Let's hear what the Pentagon spokesman, Rear Admiral John Kirby, had to say.
We continue to work with them on their counterterror capabilities inside their own country. But I'm not going to speak to specific operations.
So he's being sketchy with the details. It's estimated 65 terrorists have been killed. But will that be enough against what does seem to be a resurgent Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Matthew, if I can turn to you first. Cooperation between the US and Yemen, strikes revealing positive outcomes, though, as we said, not necessarily too detailed with their descriptions. Is this enough?
Well, it's certainly a step in the right direction. The Al-Qaeda franchise of radical Islamic extremists has actually been on the rise throughout 2013. Around the time of course, the assassination, the killing of Osama bin Laden, everybody had high hopes that would probably mark the downward spiral. And for a while, that was correct. And indeed, most of the core leadership of Al-Qaeda have been wiped out. And Al-Qaeda is not, it's not a homogeneous group, and it's not a one single entity. And it has been scattered and crushed. However, there has, throughout the previous year, been a massive upsurge in North Africa, especially as we're seeing, in Libya and all throughout, this, I feel, signifies the fact that this threat has not gone away, and it will be with us for many years to come. As Mr. Blair today made clear in a speech, he said that he feels radical Islam is the greatest threat to the West, that the West the democracies of the world are facing in the 21st century. I think that's maybe just a little bit overblown, actually. But anyway, it's still certainly going to be with us for quite some time.
Interesting, Matthew describes the sort of lack of homogeneity from within Al-Qaeda, but we have seen these sort of videos of, their little troop movements and massing them. People like Al-Wahasay saying, we're equipped now to launch attacks against America. I mean, there are these pockets, Matthew describes it, in North Africa in particular, where there seems to be a resurgence. Do you think we can afford to be, if not dismissive, we can be more measured in our response when we sort of hear about those kinds of threats, James?
Yes, I think we can be more measured about it. I mean, the fact that there are similarities between some of the rhetoric and images and styling of often quite disparate groups sometimes leads us to draw, overly large relations between them all and assume that there is more of a kind of threatening united conspiracy rather than often. I mean, there are of course links between various groups, but the links are very, very different between, the different groups have different links. And if we take them in this kind of, this is a global battle against a global threat, we will just create a global war which previously didn't exist. So there needs to be far more, far more intelligent or specific cases, which is why I'm not sure whatever is going on in Yemen is a step in the right direction. I'm not saying it's necessarily a step in the wrong direction, but we just don't know. The level of information we're provided with is so small that it is very difficult to say. And given what we have learned about the accuracy or not of drone killings so far in Yemen and the response that it's led in local population, there is some evidence that suggests that actually some of these anti-terror operations are very clearly breeding more people. Then again, we don't have all of the information, so we can't say that for sure. But my level of confidence in the capacity of Western intelligence agencies, security forces, to do this in as measured a way as we would perhaps like isn't that strong.
Just before we go, let me ask you about a bit of political campaigning, political campaign ads and how far you can go, whether you ever go too far. There's a new series of anti-immigration posters by Britain's UK Independence Party, which has caused controversy. Some people claiming they're actively racist. One poster reads, 26 million people in Europe are looking for work, and whose jobs are they after? Pretty sort of, fairly direct attempts to sort of incite ill feeling. Matthew, I'll start with you. Do you think these ads are racist, or is there at least a racist undertone to them?
Oh, certainly. I mean, most of what UKIP puts out, what it stands for, is divisive, ignorant, and offensive. They really are, bless Nigel Farage. He's extremely entertaining. I would listen to him any day more than I would listen to David Cameron, Nick Clegg, or Ed Miliband, who are so boring compared to him. But I completely and utterly 100% disagree with basically everything Nigel Farage stands for and says. And so UKIP really are sort of like the Tories' evil twin in a way. And it will be, I think, quite good actually to see both of them eat each other up, because the right will split, hopefully, at the next election. And that's what we would like to see.
Indeed. James, last word to you then on this. Do you think people actually sort of fall for these, or if not fall for them, buy into some of that rhetoric? I mean, it's a genuine risk.
Yes, I think if you look at the disparity between the percentage, the British population think the number of immigrants are, the percentage of, say, benefit fraud that the British population thinks they are, and figures like number of Muslims in the country and the actual figures, they're because they're told these things which are inaccurate every single day. By politicians and by large organs in the media, and this does cause ill feeling. So, I mean, whether it is racist in the most extreme sense, it does send out a tacit message. And we can't forget that although less obvious in form, at the 2005 election, the Conservatives had a poster which read, "It's not racist to put limits on immigration," which, you don't have to say that is. But then their caption was, their slogan was, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?" Which, maybe
it's fairly,
does.
Fairly unsubtle.
It's fairly unsubtle. So I think that these campaigns actually do work, and the response to it has been very strong, and that's good. And we just have to kind of fight like with like when it's lies.
Absolutely. That's James Schneider. Before him, Matthew Jamieson. Gentlemen, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monaco 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monaco 24.
And this is Midori House. Plenty still ahead in the programme. We're checking in with our woman in Amsterdam to see what's making the headlines there. And we'll also hear why one building right here in London became a haunt for Soviet spies. We'll be talking about theatre as well. That's all still ahead. Before that, let's hear from Bill Bingham, who has the latest World News headlines.
Investigators say they're hopeful the discovery of objects washed ashore in Western Australia will help unravel the mystery of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau is examining photographs of the objects found 10 kilometres east of the town of Augusta to establish if they're linked to the Boeing 777, which went missing in March. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia will respond if its interests in Ukraine are attacked. His comments are seen as drawing a parallel with the 2008 Georgian War. Vice President Joe Biden arrived in the capital, Kiev, on Tuesday to confirm US support for a unified Ukraine during a meeting with MPs. A senior Egyptian police officer has been killed by a bomb blast in the capital, Cairo. Security officials say Brigadier General Ahmed Zaki died when his vehicle blew up in a western suburb. A second officer has been shot dead in Alexandria during a raid on what officials say was a militant's hiding place. Rival Palestinian organizations Fatah and Hamas have announced a reconciliation deal after a meeting in the Gaza Strip. They've agreed to begin negotiations to form a unity government within the next few weeks. US President Barack Obama has arrived in Japan at the start of a tour of Asia. He'll hold a summit with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Thursday before visiting South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Speaking before the start of his tour, Mr. Obama reassured Japan that the islands at the centre of its territorial dispute with China are covered by a bilateral defence treaty. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. That was Bill Bingham. He'll be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world. Today, we're off to the Netherlands. Joining us on the line from Amsterdam is Cynthia Taylor. Welcome to the show, Cynthia. Great to speak with you as always. Let's talk about a Secret Service report to get started. Tell us about this one.
Well, that's the Dutch Intelligence and Security Service annual report, and the findings have been all over the news today because they say that over 100 Dutch Muslims have left the country to fight in Syria against President Assad. This is predominantly young people, a few minors inclusively, who are ideologically incited. They say that at least a dozen has died in combat as a result. What they find worrying, though, Tom, is that about 20 people have returned to the country. The Secret Services consider them as a potential threat to national security. They've been exposed to extreme violence and have been deeply radicalized. So they could serve as recruiters here in the Netherlands. They can help spread radical messages. They can aid in the planning of terror actions, in fact. And they can forge contacts with other international jihadists that they've met there. Now, as you know, Al-Qaeda's presence in Syria at the moment is rather strong, so the fighters must have had some contact with the group, and what the Secret Services are assuming is that they might be returning with an agenda, and Europe is seen as one of Al-Qaeda's target territories for terror attacks. And these are people who hold European passports, so they will not be attracting much attention and could easily indeed aid in any actions. But, and this is very crucial, what the Secret Services say is that while indeed these people who are returning do pose a threat to the country, it does not necessarily mean that they'll become a terrorist, and they should be looking at this in a case-by-case approach. So I suppose there's a lot of such. There's a lot still to look at this. It is actually in line with some European countries. I've said before, Tom. You know, France has mentioned 700 French Muslims have left in the last 3 years. The UK has estimated 500. What is rather worrying, though, is that this comes in a political tension period here in the country against Muslims, and in particular Moroccans. Just last month, at the back of the local elections, hardliner Geert Wilders shocked the country with a call for fewer Moroccans here. And while close to 80% of the population said they were shocked with the call, and 5,000 even formally complained and led the prosecution office to open an investigation, a new poll this week suggests that 43% do want fewer Moroccans in the country, you know, because they link Moroccans to criminality, to terrorism attacks. So I suppose there is a lot of soul-searching to be done in the Netherlands at the moment.
Indeed. Cynthia, let's talk now about, well, I guess it's a first of sorts, King's Day celebration this weekend. We know about the famous Queen's Day, but of course everything's changed, hasn't it?
It has changed. Last year was the last Queen's Day, I'm afraid. So this year we have King's Day, and Queen's Day came to exist in the late 19th century in honor of Queen Wilhelmina, and then it just continued going in different dates until last year. 30th of April was the last one, and finally the country has seen a king take the throne. So they changed the date, and instead of celebrating on the 30th of April, they're celebrating it on the 27th. Actually, this year it's not true. Actually, this year they're celebrating on the 26th, because 27th is a Sunday, and then the Dutch will not have the chance to celebrate it properly. So they just move it back to Saturday, and so everybody's gearing up for a huge party in the street. I don't know if you've ever been here on Queen's Day.
I haven't, unfortunately, but I might do. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It's the Dutch paint the town orange, basically. It's barbecues all over the place, DJs, street performance. You know, the city is transformed into a carnival or a flea market. It's just crazy. There's basically no public transportation because of the crowds take over the city. It's really, really a huge party. But the king, the former queen, used to visit a couple of towns every year for this occasion, and the king is doing that this year as well. But he says it's the last time he's doing it.
Oh dear.
Yeah, he says he wants to reform this whole idea, and so he's doing it because it has been promised, but he's tired of, you know, the silly games and the silly dancing with the crowds and all of that. So he says, no, 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 I'm going to do it this year, but next year is going to be different.
All different. Well, enjoy it while it lasts, Cynthia. I know that the polls out there show that the support for the monarchy has actually increased, so he's obviously doing some things right. Have a lot of fun this weekend. That was our Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam, looking at some of the top stories out of the Netherlands. Up next, though, on Midori House, we'll hear why one building complex in North London became a popular resident for Soviet spies. Stay tuned to find out more right here on Midori House.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. We're going to turn our attention now to one particular building in North London, only a couple of miles away from here, in fact, that served as everything from a secret residence for Soviet spies to something of a creative hub for artists and sculptors and the like. The Isokon building, in also known as Lawn Road Flats, the first modernist building in Great Britain to use reinforced concrete, but is remembered perhaps more for its notable occupants. A new book titled The Lawn Road Flats is about the stories within the building's four famous walls. And I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio now by the author of that book, David Burke. David, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for coming to speak to us. Tell me a little bit about this building then, because I guess some London connoisseurs of the architecture world will perhaps recognise it. They'll certainly know of it, and they'll know about its importance in the sort of modernist movement. It's interesting that your book details so much the sort of fascinating, detailed lives of some of its residents. Why do you think that a building like this came to represent that? Is it because modernism is a sort of was always speaking a progressive language and it encouraged progressive thinkers? What was it about? Was it just a unique chemistry? Why do you think it happened?
I think it's a building that did attract many progressive thinkers across the world, of artists, spies, writers, many, in fact. I mean, the first writer to enter was Nicolas Montserrat. And once people started arriving, they all seemed to gel. And as soon as Nicolas Montserrat gets there, the people who were the exiles from the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus was a German design centre, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know all about this. They were the next group of people to arrive at the flats, German speakers, of course. And then you had two other German speakers. One was Arnold Deutsch, who was the man who recruited the Cambridge Five, Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, John Cairncross, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, to the Russian Secret Service, lived in the flats. And he was introduced to the flats by a woman called Edith Tudor Hart. Edith Tudor Hart, her maiden name was Sushitsky, was a Bauhaus-trained photographer, a member of both the British Communist Party, in fact, and the Austrian Communist Party. And at the time of the fascist takeover, of course, many of these people faced arrest and not just incarceration, but execution. And they got out, basically, through the underground. And Jack Pritchard, the entrepreneur who created these flats, put flats aside to take refugees from both Germany and Austria. And so Arnold Deutsch, he comes in and he's probably, you know, regarded as one of the most sophisticated spies to ever operate in this country. But then there was another family that arrived in the flats, which were the Kuczynski family. And the Kuczynski family, also German-speaking, but they were from Germany, exiles from Germany or had fled Nazi Germany. And they, too, began recruiting spies. So you had two parallel networks operating in these flats. One for the GRU, which is Soviet military intelligence, and the other one was for the OMS, which is the intelligence body of the Communist International. And they didn't seem to know anything about one another, which is most peculiar. Because if anybody, if you Google the flats and you see them, you pull them up. There's 32 flats in all. There's about 7 spies living in them, more or less at the same time, running very, very important spies. The Kaczynskis ran the atomic bomb spies, the big spies, Klaus Fuchs, Bruno Pontecorvo, Alan Nunmay, Melita Norwood, big spies, you know. And Arnold Deutsch ran also, you know, probably one of the five of the most gifted spies that Britain ever produced. The trouble was they worked for the other side.
Well, exactly.
And you want to say something, I've been going on a little bit.
It intrigues me how such a situation kind of unfolded. I mean, was it some strange, you know, chemistry in the very fabric of the building, or was it just that there was this progressive attitude, a more enlightened people had a certain kind of freedom perhaps that was afforded to them? Because it seems so unlikely, as you document in the book, these extraordinary relationships, particularly as you say, people almost operating under one another's, you know, right within, almost within earshot, you imagine, and yet it continued to happen. Does the building itself explain in some way how that came about?
The building itself does explain it. I mean, I think actually if you go and look at the building, and particularly if you actually visit one of the flats, you definitely will get a feel of it. And actually, when you approach the building, if you go to Bell's Ice Park tube station, turn left or go down to Upper Park Road, I think it is, turn left there, and Lawn Road is immediately there. You walk down Lawn Road, and then suddenly this big white building hits you. It's like an ocean liner, as Agatha Christie explained, who, of course, also lived there during the war. And you see, the thing about it was the very, very first modernist... It wasn't the first modernist building in Britain, but it was the first modernist building in domestic architecture, based on the architectural principles of Le Corbusier. Le Corbusier, of course, was making the big splash in Europe. So he was the one to follow, the architects wanted to follow. This was the very first building to do so. It was the very first building in domestic architecture to use reinforced concrete. And this in itself sort of demanded new building techniques. The whole design of it is modern, minimalist, beautiful shapes, and yes, it attracted everybody who was that sort of who regarded themselves as progressive.
Let me ask you an aspect of that, because obviously you mentioned you focus in on the sort of the spy side of it, and it's there are so many compelling stories. You mentioned the sort of, you know, Cambridge Five, these sort of legendary names that people know, I guess, aspects of the story incredibly well. But you also mentioned Agatha Christie, and I wondered whether in some ways those worlds met in terms of the work you had to do to actually put the book together. Was it a bit of a detective story in a way, to piece all of these elements together, to research the book? Did you find that it's sort of the Christie stories were echoing as much as the stories of this espionage as well?
Yes, I mean, the Christie stories echoed undoubtedly so. I mean, she wrote a number of books in the flats during wartime, because she wrote her only spy novel in the flats, N or M. And it's an incredible book, because it really does have an awareness of spycraft, tradecraft, intelligence tradecraft, fifth column activity in the UK. And she's there, she's talking to the Kaczynski family, Jürgen Kaczynski and others who have control in these spies. Now, whether or not she knows anything about this is a major question. A big question, actually, because she herself at this time was investigated by MI5, or at least they looked into her, because in her book N or M, she created this character, Major Bletchley. And, of course, Bletchley Park was the government code and cipher school, where they were breaking the codes of the German networks. And they thought that because she named one of her characters Mr. Bletchley, that she knew something about this. And, in fact, two doors down from her was an individual who worked for Bletchley Park, a man called Charles Brash, a New Zealand poet whose lover, Charles Roberts, was working for MI6 and working very closely with Philby, and in fact introduced the head of counter-espionage of US counter, who would become the head of a US counter-espionage, James Jesus Angleton, to the flats. And so what you have is spies within the flats, spy catchers within the flats, artists, writers, you know, and you know, the world's probably the world's best crime novelist.
It's an incredible story, and it's detailed in fine style in the Lawn Road Flats, Spies, Writers and Artists by David Burke. David, thank you very much indeed for coming to Midori House to tell us all about it.
Many thanks.
Let's enjoy some music now on Midori House. We're hearing from David there about the secret work of Russian spies here in London. So let's stick with an espionage theme. See if you can work out where we're going with this one. It's Live and Let Die from Paul McCartney and Wings.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say,
that was Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney and Wings. It all made sense. We were talking about espionage a little earlier, in case you were wondering why we were playing that, which, let's be fair, you probably were. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's a Wednesday. That means it's time for us to review all the big stories from the world of theatre and dance. I'm happy to say we're joined in the studio by Louise Levine, novelist and dance critic for The Daily Telegraph. Louise, welcome.
Hello.
Very good to see you again. Where should we begin? Let's talk about the Royal Ballet's new production of A Winter's Tale. That's where we're going to get started, isn't it?
Yes. Now, this was a very brave and surprising decision. I mean, the world loves narrative ballet. It does well at the box office. Everyone wants to see a story. But The Winter's Tale is a tough call. I mean, there will be a short quiz afterwards, but I mean, I'll just outline the plot for you, which is that King Leontes, in a fit of jealous rage, decides that his best friend, boyhood friend, King Polixenes, has been having an affair with his wife and that his two children, one about to be born, are not his own. As a consequence, he threatens to kill Polixenes, who rushes from the country. His wife dies, his little boy dies, and he sends his baby daughter out to be left to perish on the seashore. Well, 16 years pass. The little girl has been found by a kindly shepherd and brought up as their own. Everybody piles back to the land of King Leontes, where the sorrowing king realizes the error of his ways. And a resolution is effected, but it's 16 years later. His wife is supposedly dead. We have a statue of her, they say. He goes to the statue and it melts back to life in his arms because they've been keeping her for him. A strange story.
It's a funny one. I just wondered, I mean, there's elements there which you describe where you can imagine them working incredibly effectively on stage. What kind of job is done? Is it a successful endeavour?
It's amazingly successful. It shouldn't be possible, and it is. The great choreographer George Balanchine said, there are no mothers-in-law in ballet, meaning that you can't tell a story that complex. But you can, and he does it very deftly. Christopher Wheeldon has shaved a few subplots out of the story, but basically tells it very, very simply before your very eyes, you know, nice, clearly coded characters and development. And as you say, some things really lend themselves tremendously well to dance. You know, the idea that the wife should somehow forgive this man who has been turned into a beast by his own jealousy can be realised rather beautifully in choreography. And the final pas de deux is absolutely amazing. She melts twice. You know, she comes down from that plinth and then she's still got to forgive him for all he has done, because after all, the little boy is still dead. The girl's all right, but then. And the other thing that Wheeldon does so brilliantly, as the verse does, is to build that tremendous variety into the language of dance, you know, so that first of all, you see the king being turned into this insectoid kind of monster. And then cut to act two, we're all having a lovely time in Bohemia. And there's this fantastic kind of world music vibe to the orchestration. The musicians are on stage, everyone's skipping and dancing. Folk music is the easiest thing in the world to pastiche, the easiest thing in the world to make a mess of. And Wheeldon does it really freshly and beautifully. And it's just so alive and so vibrant. The other great thing is, with, you know, Shakespeare, people dash on from the wings and say, oh, you won't believe what I just saw, a ship was wrecked. You can't have that. So Bob Crowley, who is a scenic designer of genius, actually, creates a full shipwreck with projections, and, you know, it gets its own round of applause, which is always quite good fun at the theatre.
I mean, it's interesting. I guess people are used to seeing Shakespeare as ballet. There are some, perhaps, of the narratives that lend themselves more readily. Why do you think that perhaps people haven't turned their hand to the more challenging pieces, like A Winter's Tale, more readily? Is it because you do need a combination of particular sort of creative spark and the sorts of visions of the people that you describe who are working on this production?
I think so, and I think you've got to be brave. You know, I mean, obviously, certain stories are done over and over and over again. Romeo and Juliet is the absolute classic example, because it's relatively simple. You could tell the story in 12 words if you absolutely had to. And this story, will, you know, it doesn't fit into that category at all. But then Frederick Ashton did the most wonderful job on A Midsummer Night's Dream, getting it down to 55 minutes, you know, all five acts, hardly a thing left out. And you follow completely. You know, you don't need to be kind of, as you see people sometimes, you know, when people try and bite off a little more than they could chew narrative wise, you see people kind of reading their program notes by the light of their iPhones under their coat.
Louise, do you think there are sort of golden rules then that people should follow to make particular stories, you know, work within a sort of dance narrative then? Is that a slight oversimplification? Does it require a bit more sort of nous and smarts?
Well,
than that?
Fundamentally, you're looking for characters and pretexts for engagement, you know, basically pas de deux, an excuse for a few group dances. But basically, you need big relationships. And that really is what The Winter's Tale delivers. It delivers big relationships between the men, quite apart from anything else, let alone, I'm jealous of you, my wife, I'm never going to forgive you, oh, you're going to forgive me. All sorts of different emotional colours in the dance, which is tremendously important. And you need big characters. And the great thing about this, which was so absent in Christopher Wheeldon's last big number, which was Alice in Wonderland, is that he's really worked from the talent out. And so you have a dance actor of genius like Ed Watson, who really gets his teeth into this role. It's sort of a fusion of things he's done before. You know, you can... Yes, there's a sort of stain from his evil mad Prince Rudolph from Meierling and from his account of the insect Gregor Samsa in Metamorphosis. You can sort of see that. But then dances like that, because it's written on the body, because there's muscle memory involved, you get that rather wonderful continuity. And he's really, you know, given great roles. I saw two casts. The second cast was equally amazing. You know, they're not that flush with stars at the moment, but there are a handful of them, and they've been given really good stuff to get their teeth into. So it's great, and it's going to be on in cinemas all over the world on Monday.
Wonderful stuff. That's Louise Levine describing A Winter's Tale, which is at Covent Garden till the 8th of May, I believe, and in cinemas around the world. Great stuff, Louise. Thank you very much for coming to join us on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to Louise, of course, to my guests earlier, James Schneider and Matthew Jameson, and to my producer, Phil Hahn, for producing this show. It was researched by Alexa Firmenich and Michaela Aitken, and our studio manager was Joel Church. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.